106.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're going to get a little calmer and a little more frenzied for the next 2.5 hours. Stay with us for Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pier, Robert Norse. And for the next 2.5 hours, we are going to be running through all kinds of doo-doo, mostly around civil rights issues for the poor, with an occasional musical interlude. We have a call-in number for those who want to get in touch before, after, or during the show, and even on the air. The call-in number is 423-5361 here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. So stay tuned, stay with us, and hang by your phones. We may need your input and your thoughts.
Now I sympathize with the homeless when I see them on the evening news. Somewhere there must be a place where they can park their weary shoes. Maybe a camp in the country or a building on the edge of town. But that shelter there across the street is only gonna get me down. Everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. See, I don't want to have to lock my door to be inside, safe and sound. This neighborhood will go to pot with the likes of them around. It's no fun out there in the cold. Yes, I know just how they feel. But I just can't bear to see a hungry face when I'm eating a nice warm meal. Oh, everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. I've got a friend who owns a store about a half a block away. Every year she donates goods and money to United Way. But she thinks it's bad for business to have the homeless walking by. She says, why not send them south for the winter so they can stay warm and dry? Oh, everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. Well, now please understand our position. It's not the way it looks. We want them housed, but out of sight. There are zoning laws on the books. Long as we can clear our conscience and preserve our civic pride, we'll give our consent, even pay the rent on a place where they can hide. 'Cause everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. Yes, we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else.
That was Mark Levy, The Homeless Shuffle, from his 1980s album, Take Off Your Clothes. We're going to be stripping down with that song a little later in the show for all of you nudists and or clothes optional folks. It's a great tape from Nuclear Records in Felton. If you want a copy of this tape, give a call to 338-7283 and fork over, I think it's $8. These are great songs by Mark Levy, a lot of them topical from the 80s, about 10 years ago, and some of them still quite pertinent. Chief Justice Rehnquist, for instance, which we'll also be playing later, and Urban Renewal, On the Move, the attack on the move folks in Philadelphia, some of whom are still fighting for basic rights, and one of whom, of course, is still in jail, Mumi Abu Jamal, connected with the move group. Though jailed in another incident. We got a lot of stuff today on Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, which we want to get through. And we got some announcements before we begin about upcoming meetings, which I'm going to hope to repeat at the end of the show in case you miss them now. There is, of course, a Citizens Police Review Board meeting, as regular listeners probably know, happening tomorrow. That's Monday, the 5th of January. At 915 Cedar Street at the headquarters of the Citizens Police Review Board. Important for many of us because it's the second meeting around the Happy John Dine slaying of last November. Those of you who have been following this program know that there has been considerable concern that police accounts differ widely from those of other eyewitnesses, and the decision of Police Chief Steve Belcher and District Attorney Art Danner 16 hours after the shooting, actually Belcher made a decision, it sounded like 3 hours after the shooting, that it was a justifiable homicide, and more important, that the story that they were believing was that of the friend of the shooter, the friend of the killer. Officer Connor Carey was the man who killed Happy John Dine. His friend, and also the complaining witness Ben Newman, was in the back of the vehicle when this happened, and it was his account that became the official cover story. Both a cover story in the sense of the lead story and a story in the sense of which many of us believe was a cover-up story that didn't really reflect the majority of the eyewitness's testimony. So on Monday, the Citizens Police Review Board, which initially took seemed very little interest in the case, didn't call any special hearings or much less emergency hearings, didn't contact any of the folks and any of the independent witnesses or folks with videotapes, now apparently is beginning to show an interest. The beast is beginning to stir a little bit, perhaps. Who knows? Come and see for yourself, 530 915 Cedar, which is the corner of Cedar and Locust, kind of across from the Santa Cruz Hotel and the Santa Cruz, the new kind of upscale taqueria you find on the corner there. And it's in the same large block as the library, though, kind of on the other end of the block. That's 915 Cedar, 530 tomorrow, Citizens Police Review Board. If you can't come, give them a call. And even if you can come, give them a call. Tell them your concerns about the Happy John Dine case, 429-3262. It is particularly important that people who have not yet come to these board meetings come, because they are the only ones who will be allowed to speak at oral communications, or such is our fear. That's the only open part of this meeting tomorrow at 530. So if you haven't come to these meetings before, or specifically to the last meeting, and you haven't spoken, now's your chance to speak. Now's your chance to get information out to the board before they go into closed session and decide whether to sustain or to throw out the complaints against the police officers and the police chief, because apparently some complaints are also about the police chief in the shooting of Happy John Dine. Now, on Tuesday, there had been sort of indications that there was a city council meeting, a special city council meeting at 3 o'clock for advisory body interviews in the council chambers, and then a tentative meeting at 5 and 7 for public hearings. But that has not been confirmed, and the city clerk's office was not open on Friday to receive an agenda, nor has such an agenda been posted on the Internet. So my suspicion is there isn't going to be a city council meeting on Tuesday, but I could be wrong. The Sentinel doesn't mention it in its little Sunday box. If you check for events of the week in the Sentinel, you can often find events there that happen. Sometimes they give the wrong time, and frequently they even omit them, so they're not really a very reliable source. But for those of you who want to follow city council and homeless rights struggle, human rights for poor people in the city council meetings, We're not sure if there's one on Tuesday. The way for you to find out is to go to the city clerk's office or give them a call, or to call the city council chambers, 429-3550. You can actually call them today, leave them a message on their 24-hour message line, and they will call you back with information about it, since it's sort of an unclear situation. You can also call me at HUF headquarters. HUF is the organization I work with, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Give me a call at 423-HUF, and I'll try to pass on the word, maybe even put it on my message tape when and if I learn what's going on with City Council on Tuesday. But there definitely will be a meeting Monday, the Citizens Police Review Board, and you can call them now, 24-hour message line, 429-3262, 429-3262. Write that one down and give them a call. And at any time during this two-and-a-half-hour show you don't catch the numbers, you, of course, can call in and ask me on the air at 423-5361, and our lines are open. Or you can call me off-air at 423-HUF after the show, and I will call you back and give you any numbers which you may have missed, because we often give out lots of different numbers for folks to call in and help out with different kinds of struggles happening in different places. What else we got coming up? Well, there's we got a call right before the show from a correspondent that a body is washed up on the beach, a homeless man whose head was beaten in. We don't know if this is true. We're still waiting for details. So far, it's unconfirmed, but that was a preliminary report we received before airtime. We're also hoping to have an interview with TRUSC, Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz. Marco and Donna, ever vigilant for folks who are on the edge of getting bounced by rapacious landlords. I'm hoping to give them a call later and do an interview with them. We're going to have taped interviews with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs in San Francisco, talking about the crisis up there in Golden Gate Park. We're going to have the promised 40-minute segment of last Monday's Citizens Police Review Board, where programmer Becky Johnson, who's now producing the show somewhat, has strung together and put together some cuts from the Citizens Police Review Board for us to listen to. You get to hear not the board itself, but those who came to the last meeting of the Happy John Dine case and what they had to say. And we'll be going directly into that after this introduction. Jennifer Wagoner of Santa Monica is out of jail, but faces even more jail for trespass and, quote, resisting arrest, perhaps screaming too loud. We're not quite sure. This is in her attempt to secure housing for homeless people in Santa Monica by peacefully occupying and fixing up an abandoned and boarded up motel, the Flamenco Motel, which we've talked about in past interviews. We'll be hearing from her on that. We also get an interview from a security guard in Santa Cruz who has moved to Santa Barbara and gives us a report on what's happening down there, as well as a sort of a look back at Santa Cruz from a security guard's point of view. And finally, we also have an interview with Tony Bowl, attorney at law, talking about the last year in court and, I guess, the upcoming year, because he has several cases, including a case with the Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcaster Bob Duran, which will be coming up on January 7th for all you court hounds. Go down there at 8:30 in the morning. Check the rosters, the court calendars for Bob Duran, D-U-R-A-N, and support Bob at his arraignment. Who knows? Maybe the prosecution will get smart and cut the case right there. We'll see. He was Bob, of course, faced charges for engaging and being a reporter in a park where the police didn't want him to be, and suffered not only an arrest, jail, but also confiscation of his equipment for doing so. We're hoping that that can be rectified. We're also going to be doing updates on the sleeping ban, which is going to be out, believe it or not, in petition form early this week. We have the whole thing ready. We're taking it to the printers Monday or Tuesday. It will be there on Wednesday. We're going to need volunteers. Give a call to 457-9754 extension. Oh, boy. I'm going to have to ask my producer to give me a call on that one, because I'm not quite sure of the extension. I'm not even going to venture a guess. What I'm going to do instead is give a call to 423-HUF on that issue. We've got reports on sleeping tickets. We've got reports on other ticket fights. We're going to be talking about the drug prohibition war. We've got a full plate, and we've even got a phone call, which I'm going to take on air. We'll see if this person even wants to be on air.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, we all want you, Robert.
Oh, this sounds like my producer, Becky Johnson.
I don't know about that somewhat comment, but anyway, persons who are interested in contacting or helping out with the sleeping ban repeal initiative, especially people who are registered voters in the city of Santa Cruz who can legally collect signatures, are all wanted and needed. And they should call 457-9754, extension 182.
182, that was it. I'm glad you called in and let us know about that, Becky. I was going to say 802 or something. 182.
Yeah, don't make it up.
182. I'm glad we have the
always
exact
a bad philosophy in journalism.
So that's 457-9754, extension 182 for those who want to help out with the sleeping ban repeal initiative.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Becky, for the call there. And do give a call again one more time, 457-9754, extension 182, if you want to help with the sleeping ban repeal initiative. And if you want to get in touch with me, it's 423-5361 here in the studio. And what we're going to do now is we're going to go through some highlights of the Citizens Police Review Board meeting that happened last Monday. There'll be more highlights this Monday, particularly if you make them. So make sure you show up at 915 Cedar at 5:30 tomorrow. In the meantime, here's some of what happened.
I'm not aware of you yet having, although you may have it, that I consider the absolute.
Now, the first speaker is Ray Glock Grunike, who for years single-handedly took every sleeping ban ticket that came his way. He became very concerned about the Happy John case and is talking to the board about some of those concerns.
Investigation, and I'm concerned that a premature appointment of an independent investigator could take away your authority, or could cloud your authority to get that evidence. And the evidence I'm concerned mostly about is the tape of conversations between officers carry and or over with the police dispatcher, which occurred from the point of contact with Mr. Niven to the point of the shooting. And my reason for doing that is that I cannot conceive of, well, I shouldn't put it in such absolute terms, but in my view, it seems likely that the contents of that tape and what was said within the contact lines of the police communication prior to the shooting itself will be most revelatory of two points. One is to whether the account of there being of Mr. Dine reportedly, allegedly brandishing with a gun earlier in the evening was an account that predated the shooting or is an account that was made up after the shooting. Very, very critical in terms of the credibility determination that this board has tonight. And second, there was something on what I understand is the county death certificate that made me even more concerned about getting that evidence.
30 seconds.
Thank you. And then it says here, the scene seen by passerby putting gun in fanny pack. I was wondering whether or not that was information derived possibly from the police department and whether this might be a more accurate contemporaneous version of what Mr. Niven told them rather than an actual brandishing, and that perhaps after the shooting there was an amplification or elaboration to make it seem like there had been brandishing. And I'm encouraging you to get that evidence before your authority to do so next wrong. Thank you.
And we're going to interrupt the hearing of the Citizens Police Review Board from last Monday to bring you a phoned interview with correspondent Mike Balderas, who has been examining, well, he's got some news on the story, this breaking story about a body on the beach.
Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, what's up? This is Mad Mike Wonderdog. I'm just back in from Chicago, and I went down to Henry Cowell Beach this morning and just drink a beer and get a little bit of peace and whatever, and I ran across a dead body. It seemed like, I thought it was a seal at first, and I wasn't really tripping because it was dead seagulls and stuff laying all around. And this Australian girl, it was like 25 feet away off the shore, and it washed up on the beach, and it was, it seemed like it was some homeless guy I seen at Coral Street. He was naked and looked like he had, his head was all bashed in, trauma, like maybe some blunt instrument or something. Had a big bruise on his right above his hip. Kind of fucked me up because I was sitting there. I just came from Chicago, and it's like they're killing people all over there in L.A., and they're killing people there and all this. Couldn't wait to get back to good old Santa Cruz, and this kind of fucked my whole tranquility and everything up to see this body.
About what time, Mike, did you see this?
It was about 8:20, 8:30.
Was anyone else there? Were the police there?
Or? Yeah, the police showed up, and they'd taken pictures of it, and it's kind of fucked up. He was, like, on his back. I thought it was, like, a shark attack or something like that. The dude was naked, and I couldn't see his leg at first. He had it, like, folded up under. I thought the sharks had ate him up or something like that, but it seemed like his body was intact. There was no bullet holes or knife marks or something like that, but it seemed like somebody had beat him to death with a baseball bat or iron pipe or something. I've seen him down in Coral Street before.
What did you recognize about him that made you think he was someone from Coral Street?
He seemed like he was like about 45 to like 49, 50 years old, small goatee, white male, about 5'10", maybe about 180 pounds. He was kind of bloated too because he'd been in water a couple of days, so it was kind of hard to tell he was past the rigor mortis stage.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen dead bodies before, so I can, like, I'm not a coroner or maybe a, you know, medical doctor like that, but I've seen a lot of dead bodies, so I can figure out time of death roughly about 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. Been in the water. Okay.
So did you speak to any of the other witnesses who were there, or did you hear anything the police said that might be of use for us to know?
Yeah, if they were trying to downplay the whole shit. They were trying to say that there's no foul play here, you know. I said, well, how come the dude was naked, you know? And I said, well, why is he all beaten up about the head? Oh, well, you know, the surf, I beat him up, Andy Crane and Lefevre and the rest of them was down there. And they said, you know, the surf kind of like pounded him up against the rocks. But what's so crazy about the whole damn thing was that if he was all beaten up and pounded by the surf, how come just his head was all beaten all up? You know, his elbows, his legs, his shin, and the rest of the part of his body was kind of bloated, but there was no bruises, contusions, and nothing like that. And no black and blue marks. The eye was all black. It looked like somebody pulped his head with something, some type of blunt instrument. They didn't turn. I started to pull him out of the water and put my jacket over him.
Actually discovered him first?
I saw him first, but I thought it was a dead seal because it was like dead seagulls and stuff. Right? He was like 25 feet offshore. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a dead seal. I mean, dead seals and whales and seagulls laying all around everywhere, so I didn't really trip. So I got about 75 feet away from it, and it started raining. I got underneath the old Dream Inn. I forgot what's the name of it now. They changed the owners. And I was out of the rain sitting there reading Shogun, my book, and then this Australian girl started walking down the beach, and she ran up to me and told me, dial 911. There's a body out there. He had washed up by the time I was sitting there drinking my beer. And I ran down there and saw it. And
did you dial the 911 call?
No, somebody from the Dream Inn. It was like people were coming out of the Dream Inn, looking and gawking and all that. Somebody else dialed it. I didn't have time to. I was like in shock. I was like going because I got up real close up on him. I'm going, hey, I think I know this dude. I've seen him before. So I was like standing there, like staring at him, his head lolling around in the surf and all that. And I didn't know what to do. I started to pull him out of the water. But
how long did it take the police to arrive?
They came pretty quick. About 5 minutes, they were there.
Huh? And did you notice anything else about the body that you want to tell us? Did you were you close to it for a period of time?
Oh yeah, yeah. I almost gagged. Almost chucked my whole beer up. It was one thing. And I mean, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes, like I say, coroner to figure out, because they're trying to downplay the whole. That's what made me suspicious of shit. They're trying to downplay the whole shit, saying there's no foul play here. And they didn't want to turn him over and touch him, and I'm like, I started to pull him out. I said, good thing you didn't touch him. I said, we're going to pull him out of the water. What, you're going to just let him lay there on the beach? And it looked like the tide was coming in. Mm-hmm. But it was like threatening to take him back out to sea. They was trying to say there's no foul play and nothing like that. And what struck my mind was that if what is true, what they said, that he's, because he's a Henry Cowell Beach, there's no rocks there except for Streaming Lane, around the Streaming Lane area. He was like about the middle of the beach. What made me seem suspicious was that if he had indeed maybe committed suicide, got naked and dove off the cliff or something like that, or drowned himself or whatever, accidental death, him being naked was suspicious for one thing. Him having his head all bashed up and bruised like that, when no other parts of his body was all bruised, no parts of his body was bruised, like his shins, his knees, his elbows. If he had been pounded against the surf or the rocks or something like that, he would have had the rest of his body. It would have been contusions and bruises and all this stuff. It was just his head. So that led me to suspect that somebody had beat the man to death and threw him in the ocean.
Well, thank you, Mike. Anything you want to add to this?
Oh, God. I just fucked my whole day up, that's all. I'm just like, I'm going to get pleasantly fucked up, do me a speedball, and masturbate and smash the fascist state.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers.
Well, breaking news story from Mike Balderos on the beach, and no doubt we'll catch the official version tomorrow, the next day, or next week sometime in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Don't know. Maybe the body will be identified, and we'll get some more information as to who this was, whether the individual was homeless, whether foul play is now suspected, whatever. Could be dived into the sea and hit the rocks with his head, who knows. But it could be, as Mr. Balderos suggests. Let's continue now with the Citizens Police Review Board hearing after this, of course, phone call from a listener.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hello, I was listening to the news about the homeless people.
Yes.
And this is just something that has to do with our culture. I'll try to keep it brief.
Sure, take your time.
I think it's kind of frightening how people can regard homeless as almost like a separate species, the lack of compassion and the hate crimes against the homeless. I mean, it always puzzled me how, why so many people become so hateful towards the homeless. You hear these sad stories about them being beaten up, you know, and attacked in their camps and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be apparent at the beginning, but it ties into our treatment of animals in general. Because a society that accommodates cruelty to homeless people is also a society that is lacking of compassion enough not to care about the sufferings of billions of farm animals and helpless chickens who are tortured.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a continuum. All violence is a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And in our society, you could just go ahead and shove your face full of cheeseburgers and McNuggets, and people don't think what's on the end of their fork, all the suffering that represents. I mean, we've all heard about how the food animals are treated so cruelly. And if we can blunt our emotions enough not to care about helpless little, you know, birds being tortured so we can shove them in our faces, then it goes hand in hand with us not caring about homeless people or about people who are different than us, different race, different religion, and it all ties in. So I think the whole thing in a nutshell is lack of compassion from meat eating, which causes our hatred of the homeless and the perpetuation of war on the planet.
I see.
Because even the SPCA hands out articles like pamphlets that show that children who are beaten by their parents or treated cruel take it out on animals because their compassion has been blunted. So in a nutshell, it's all about awareness of trying to be compassionate. And I think even if you're a good person who eats meat, who tries to help, you know, social justice causes, even if you care deeply about the homeless and how they suffer, if you purchase meat, you're perpetuating the system that makes room for homeless people, because a world that can accommodate a little boy being cruel to a puppy is also the same world that accommodates Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would also encourage those who are concerned with animal rights to extend their concern to those of local homeless oppression here in the community. I know many of them do, and I think that it's really an interesting linkage that you bring up.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand. I mean, the first thing people will say is, well, do you like animals better than people? Aren't loggers more important than owls, et cetera, et cetera? And when you rank evil, when you rank cruelty, that's what perpetuates cruelty, because the logger who loses his job is just as important as the owl, and the homeless person is just as important as the chicken or the cow who was mistreated. I mean, all evil is simply evil. I mean, a boy pulling the wings off of an insect is just as evil as a person shooting a person, and so it all perpetuates the rule of might makes right, which is the rule of power over.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we should just try to live our lives without being cruel to anything and not fall into the false argument that it's worse to be cruel to a human than it is to be cruel to an animal, because they're all equally evil. There's no one is worse than the other.
Right. And I would also, as I said before, urge those concerned with environmental issues and issues of cruelty to animals to pay equal attention to the human environment here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, it's scary because this, of course, a person looks shabby and they're out in the cold and they can't get clean. People just distance themselves and regard these people as if they're just nothing. You know, the same way we disregard the feelings of animals. It's just a blunting of our compassion.
Well, I invite you to come, if you've been listening to the show, to the Citizens Police Review Board meeting tomorrow, which concerns, of course, the shooting death of one of our street people who has been homeless and who was a homeless rights activist, Happy John Dine.
I think it's suspicious how they just jumped on it and right away said, oh, it's justifiable without, like, you know, 10 minutes after it happened. I mean, I'm exaggerating.
Very quickly, 3 hours.
Right, you know. But I think your station is terrific and keep it up.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This segment of the show, we are taking both calls and trying to kind of review last Monday's Citizens Police Review Board hearings around Happy John Dine, the man who was shot 2 bullets to the gut and hauled away. His ashes dropped over the Pacific within 2 weeks. The case closed within a week and a half. And now the Citizens Police Review Board hopefully will begin to weigh the evidence in a fashion that both the police department and the district attorney's office apparently didn't feel they needed to do. Here again is more discussion from Monday, last Monday, and of course those hearings will continue tomorrow.
Mike Ackerman, 260 High Street. I just want to emphasize the absolute necessity for an independent investigation of this and it be public. The internal contradictions in the district attorney's report are beyond ridiculous. They're mind-boggling, and this cannot be swept under the rug. This is something that must be independently investigated. Police departments cannot investigate themselves. They've never succeeded in doing it anywhere in the country. There is no reason to expect it to be done in Santa Cruz.
Thank you. I went in this Saturday and I read, I have sent you all the facts, you can copy up, but I'll just reiterate.
This is David Silva
and
speaking.
And read a ways into the report up to the police officer's testimony, in other words, the witnesses. I was very, very disturbed to find that the account of my testimony was not what I said, it's not true, and it's inaccurate, and it's very, very sparse, and if you read it yourselves, you know that I told you a lot more than what's there. So that concerns me. I was not driving on the freeway, it was not 2 days before I heard the news, I was actually listening to the news and the shooting on the radio at the time. Those inaccuracies, if there are similar inaccuracies in other testimonies, that might explain some of the contradictions. And reading over the testimonies, I was amazed how many contradictions there were. The two officers, Shannon Gannon, witnesses, Shannon Gannon, I think is the fellow's name, and his girlfriend, also former acquaintances of Officer Carey. There's a contradiction. One of them says they made the call 911 in the vehicle. The other one says they made the 911 call at home. Those kind of contradictions may be cleared up if you clear up the inaccuracies. The only way the inaccuracies will be cleared up is if you have the testimony taken over again of these witnesses. Now, I know that your job is very difficult. The Rashomon effect of, you know, every witness sees something from different perspective, I'm very quite aware of. I did research in UCLA, graduate level work at UCLA, on the psychological aspects of the law, and I've done voir dire and research on witnesses to know that all you can do is phrase the question differently and you get a different answer from the witness. But what I expect is a high level of integrity from DA Marty Crowell, who I really felt quite confident in giving my testimony to, but I'm very, very shocked and disappointed with what is actually in the report. That's why I sent my facts so that you'll have additional information other than what's in the report. If the report is inaccurate, then I don't know what you can do except have an independent investigation. I have other concerns too, but perhaps other people will spell out the different contradictions. I'm sure you've noticed them yourselves. And like I said, they're to be expected to some extent, but they must be cleared up.
And that was David Silva, a Green Party candidate, city council candidate at the last 1996 election, and ex-organizer extraordinaire, talking at the Citizens Police Review Board. Those who are active locally know that David is a whirlwind of activity in terms of both organizing and helping others to organize around important public issues. Interestingly enough, he is one of the few people who bring up specific contradictions in the district attorney's report, which is in the library and can be read by anybody who walks into the library. Today, the library is open from 12 to 5 for those of you who want to take a look at that report. And I believe the library is open on Monday as well. Really important thing to do is to start reading through that report. Has a lot of interesting police reports as well as some interviews with the district attorney. What we would wanted to get to the Citizens Police Review Board but may not be able to because we haven't had enough researchers is to go through that report and point out contradictions. David, of course, read his report and pointed out, as you heard, that it didn't reflect what he told the investigators or what happened. So somewhere along the line, either through shoddy reporting or through, dare I say it, deliberate distortions, who knows what happened, but in any case, you heard him say publicly on the record that what they wrote down, what the police officers and or district attorney's office wrote down, is not what he said and not what happened. And what we need to do is get every single witness who is in that report to take a look at it again and see if, in fact, what they write adequately reflects what they were told. It seems strange, as I said, the overwhelming evidence where you have more than 10 eyewitnesses saying they saw no weapon in Happy John Dine's hand. By this I mean a toy gun, even a toy gun. Nothing in Happy John's hand, nothing pointed at the police, no threatening stance, no combat stance, and no threatening behavior. Those allegations come from the police officers and from Ben Newman. And it's before the Citizens Police Review Board makes its final decision on this case, which may happen as early as tomorrow. Perhaps we'll have another week to give them to point out to them the contradictions in the report. Perhaps not. But the real people to point out those contradictions are those who have, if you've been interviewed by the district attorney's office or by the police around this issue, please go directly to the library and read that report. And even if you haven't, go read that report to educate yourself on what is going on and why some of us have spent so many hundreds of hours, and that's really what it amounts to now for some of us, insisting that this case be reopened. Continuing now with the Citizens Police Review Board. This is a Barbara Jackson, who's a concerned citizen.
Okay, I didn't plan to speak, but I just wanted to follow up on what the two speakers already said, and to mention I also looked through a little bit more than half of the report, and I did submit a five-page letter for each of you, which I wrote last night. I hope you'll have a chance. And that kind of fits in with some of the things that Ray says that I felt haven't been looked into that I believe should be. And also, to follow up on what the last speaker said, because of the information I got from the report, I called one of the people to get a little bit more information on it. And I'll give you his name in private. I don't want to do it publicly. But what his reaction was, he was very surprised anything was in the report because he said he had not testified. So I just thought that I should follow what the previous gentleman said.
A man? Would you give your name, please?
I did, Barbara Jackson.
All right.
That's all right.
My name is Laura Tucker, and I unfortunately haven't had a lot of time to go through the report. I'm busy and with my baby. But I'm concerned from people that I've spoken with that have read the report, and I want to encourage you to look at any significant conflict in especially the testimony of Carrie Newman and Officer Over. I think that that's really important. And I'm also concerned with the short amount of time that the police department, the district attorney, and the chief of police came to their conclusions and, frankly, what their motives were for doing that. And as much as I love Happy John, which I did know him personally, I think I'm even more concerned with how the process, how this happened, and how they... So I'd like to encourage you to look at, if you feel that that the conclusions were come to in haste? And if so, why were they come to so hastily? And what can we do about that so that that's not going to happen in the future? Because I don't feel safe. I was homeless last year, and I feel like some of our citizenry is more safe than others in terms of police misconduct and abuse. And I think that all of our citizens should be safe. And I'm really concerned about the police department and the behavior of the district attorney. I hope that you do get to listen to the radio transcripts. There's several things that I will be looking for when I do read the report, like them screaming, "Don't move," after shots were fired. I'm curious if they said, "Don't move," before shots were fired. Also, if there was a report of a citizen waving a possibly real firearm at other citizens, what precautions did they take in the way that they approached him? I think that's real important. Did they call for backup first? I don't know if they did. That would probably be on the tape.
I met Davidson, I have 200 bucks. Instead of going with the oral communications, I have an issue which is more background, but I think it's something that should be considered by you at the time of making deliberations on this issue as well as.
You're now hearing Ed Davidson at the Citizens Police Review Board hearing. Ed is a longtime city council watcher and critic who frequently speaks to city council on a number of issues, and he felt this issue was important enough to come to the Citizens Police Review Board. Prior to that, you heard Laura Tucker, who is the California Homeless Civil Rights Action Network point person in Santa Cruz, homeless herself, newly a mother, a friend of Happy John Dine, who expressed a number of concerns about the police reports.
Future issues, and that has to do with selective enforcement of the laws and on the books. Just as an example, this alcohol, the banning of open alcohol cans on the beach in the county, they announced that they were only going to enforce it selectively. Well, you don't pass a law and announce that you're only going to pass it selectively. That's the worst thing you could do is because you essentially have no law. If you only apply it to certain people, people you don't like their looks, their color, whatever, what they're wearing. So it was with the sidewalk ordinances. And our police have been selectively enforcing the sidewalk ordinances, if you know about that. Now, in the instant case, I think there was a part of the tragedy was that the beat officer, this officer involved, was not a beat officer who knew the characters that existed up and down Pacific Avenue, apparently due to the beat. And someone who had been there would probably know the person and know that that person would not be carrying a loaded weapon. So, in my mind, when you start selectively enforcing laws on the books and you have inexperienced officers in terms of the people and the location, it invites the kind of tragedy that happened. Thank you.
And that was Ed Davidson bringing up an interesting point, which is Officer Over was a long-time officer on the mall. At least he'd been spending a lot of time in the prior months. In fact, we'd heard a number of complaints about his behavior. But it's interesting that it wasn't Officer Over who shot and killed Happy John Dine. And, again, I'm merely speculating here. What else can we do at the moment? But it may have been that the reason Officer Over did not do anything of the kind was because he knew full well Happy John Dine was not a dangerous person. Annoying, abrasive perhaps, but certainly not dangerous. And he probably, and again I'm speculating, I'll ask the question, I won't even put it as an assertion, did he know that Happy John Dine played with toy guns? Perhaps he did. If that was the case, then why didn't he communicate that fact to Officer Carey as they arrived? And indeed, there seems to be some indication that there was, according to eyewitness Mike Schultz, a dispute between the two officers, and I think that may have been confirmed by witness Tom Murphy, about this shooting. I'm not quite sure, actually. I think Murphy may not have seen it. He may have left before it happened. But there are several eyewitnesses who state, one of them was, I believe, Schultz, that there was essentially an argument, an angry argument between the two officers immediately after the shooting. And I ask, was that officer over saying, "You fool, you've just shot a man who's harmless"? I don't know. And we need to question the officers into exactly what happened afterward much more closely than the police have questioned them, and then the district attorney have, the investigators from that office have questioned them. Continuing with the Citizens Police Review Board Monday hearing. Notoriety this summer when her testimony sent Michael Balderos, the man who just called in on the phone about the body on the beach, to jail for 2 months for allegedly vandalizing City Hall. Reynolds' testimony was viewed by many as, if not deliberately and maliciously false, certainly wrong, and she was. It was later discounted when she was held in several mental wards throughout the country, and then indicted by the federal authorities in New Mexico for terrorist threats, claiming that a truck loaded with explosives was headed to blow up the federal building in Albuquerque, as well as she was also indicted for possession of methamphetamine. And as I mentioned in my last show, she was released, and she's back in Santa Cruz again, and she did show up her first public appearance that I'm aware of at the Citizens Police Review Board hearing, and she gave this testimony in which she was one of the few witnesses, perhaps the only witness, to in essence suggest that they not do an independent investigation and ignore the brouhaha and let the police department's verdict stand of justifiable homicide.
First, I'd like to read a letter to S.C. Michael, still waiting to be printed. It will be printed either this week or next week. Okay, don't even tell me that SCPD is responsible for Happy John's death. They're not. Let me explain. Sometimes mental health gets people they consider lost causes. To those people, a drinker is withheld. Example, in the last few weeks, more than twice each, I have hung myself, cut my wrist and stomach, and been drugged into MHU. I am kept a few hours, released to do it again. I'm a lost cause, not worthy of their help. In Happy's case, I know that he's been in there. He was so frequent in this system, they gave up. From there, things escalated. It's a true tragedy that Happy's life ended this way. I wonder if mental health is celebrating one less homeless case that cost me time and money. Has anyone considered the feelings of the officers involved who may never be the same after having to pull the trigger? When all is said and done, this could have been prevented by adequate mental health care that's all too often refused to those who really need it the most. But the blame where it belongs is not on SCPD, but on the system that fails people daily, thus putting a strain on our public servants and on our society. Next is my statement. In other cities around the country, children ages 7 to 12 have been shot due to toy guns. This death, however tragic, was 100% justified and no different than those. Robert Norris's letters and cries for an independent investigation are no more than attempts to gain attention, power, and control, and what I believe is an attempt to destroy officers' Carey and Overman. Happy's behavior and unpredictability caused this, as did mental health, not making him a client, as they do with a lot of us. Officer Carey did what he is trained to do, and now I feel he is being punished by the amount of terrorism he has to face. Holding an independent investigation will do nothing to make these people contented. Nothing anyone can do or say will satisfy them, except time to burn themselves out. What we're hearing isn't advocacy for Happy John. It's not activism, and it's been mostly one-sided until now. Please allow this to rest. An independent investigation isn't necessary except to give Mr. Norris and his followers that much more power and control. The shooting is justified. It's over. Pray something like this never happens again. And excuse me, Mr. Norris, please stop exploiting people in situations less fortunate than yourself. Stick a fork in its butt. Turn it over. It's done. Then you work.
Mm-hmm. So actually, Kitten Reynolds was the only witness who, only public person there who testified really against an independent investigation. And one has to credit her with the courage to go up against the majority view. For my own part, I have to say that she was reading a letter to the Metro, which perhaps will be printed in the next issue, along with a letter that I'm going to be reading to you later in this show, which they said they're also going to print. And so the public spectacle will go on, but hopefully the real issues will be peripherally revealed here. I mean, the Metro Santa Cruz feeds on spectacle, and certainly this these personal attacks back and forth are a form of spectacle. The real question whether an independent investigation needs to be held, the answer to that question lies in whether the police department and the sheriff's department and the district attorney's office is sufficiently, impartial or separated from involvement in the case to be able to fairly consider the situation. And you can, of course, look at the reputations of both these departments and consider that, or you can just go straight to the district attorney's report, which is in the library, and see if you, as a person reading all those reports, would come to the same conclusion that Chief Belcher and District Attorney Art Danner did, namely that this was justifiable and that what actually happened was what witness Ben Newman and Officer Over and Officer Carey said. I have no desire, by the way, to ruin the careers of any of these guys. I do think that Officer Over needs to be retrained, and if he's abusing the rights of people downtown, he needs to be stopped from doing that. That's not destroying him. That is, should we say, protecting the community and suggesting that some individuals, if they can't be retrained, need to go do something else. I don't know. It's not a personal attack on either of these officers. And Officer Carey, again, the real concerns that a lot of us have are not the individual officers on the beat. Even Officer Carey, who made a serious mistake here, even if you believe his story to the max, he shot an innocent man with a toy gun. And that's wrong, that's bad, that is something that Dine's friends suffer for, Dine died for, and Officer Carey, no doubt himself, suffers for. But the real question is, what about the higher-ups, and what are they doing when these things happen? Chief Belcher, Lieutenant Locke, Lieutenant Saponi, Sergeant Seeley, the folks who supposedly are our fearless investigators. You know, are they giving us a fair and impartial investigation? And if they're not doing so in as serious a case as the Happy John Dine case, how can we expect them to do so in cases where there isn't a shooting and there isn't a lot of public pressure? You be the judge. Let's hear more from the Citizens Police Review Board from last Monday.
Star,
a friend of Happy John's and a street person, as well as a guitarist.
I no longer feel safe in this community. I'm going back to Hawaii. I've lived in this community on and off since 1979. I've been back in Santa Cruz almost 2 years. I've been watching Officer Martin Over for about the last year or two. And I think serious warrant should be given to his mental stability or apparent possible lack of it. You know, I think after such a tragic incident, I'm not so sure I'd be so stable myself if I put myself in his shoes. But I've noticed he's been very edgy. An incident occurred a few nights ago, and a woman was harassed on the street, and he almost gave her a ticket, and we went to explain that somebody almost accosted her, and he like almost went for his gun, and his hand was like right by it, like he thought we were going to jump him or something. We were just trying to have a peaceful, intelligent conversation with him, and the other officer that was with him was very polite and courteous and easy to talk to, and I'm glad he was there. But he refused to talk with us, and I'm not trying to throw stones per se, but people make mistakes, whether they're cops or street people, you know, and I think this, you know, incident is tragic, and I think we all need to work together as a community, but it's not the street people or the so-called criminals in this town that make me feel unsafe here. It's certain members. There's a lot of people in this police department I have a lot of respect for, and I get along perfectly well with, but there's also certain individuals in the police department that don't make me feel safe here, and I'm leaving. Goodbye.
I, too, encourage a public investigation into this matter. I would like to know personally, and I think the community should know, what the psychology of this police officer was.
And this is Marco, who is an activist in the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, and we're going to be calling him, actually, shortly after the segment of the show where the Citizens Police Review Board hearings is over. So he himself came to the hearing and spoke.
He was able to pull the trigger on a gun and shoot Santa Cruz and point it towards someone who he should have known was a common visitor to the mall and had these types of problems, which were not ever to be found violently with the gun. I'd like to know where the intelligence was for that day, who the sergeant was on shift, and why that sergeant didn't have enough resources to go there to where Happy was with undercover agents or undercover people who patrol them all out of uniform, to scope him out, to check him out, to identify him as Happy, who's on the wall, not known for possessing guns. Where is that information? Where is that intelligence? Why wasn't that happening for that day? Okay, I would like to know what the psychology of this officer was for the 2 weeks, let's say, before he pulled that trigger. Now this shooting happened in a month of national protest against police brutality. I would like to know what the police officers in Santa Cruz County was talking about that month. What the locker room talk was about. Oh, this national police brutality, bull, blah, 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 blah. What are they getting all fired up about this? I'd like to know what the psychology of the police officers was for that month, for his personal psychology for the 2 weeks before this. What led up in his brain where he felt like he could shoot this person who's obviously indigent or probably could never afford a gun in his life? You know, guns cost $500, $600. And also, there's the information that I have that he grew up in Santa Cruz and belongs to the surf culture. Now I know there's a counterculture out there among the surfers who are called surf Nazis. Okay? And these surf Nazis have always, historically in Santa Cruz, been belligerent and arrogant and violent towards homeless people, transients, undesirables, etc., whatever you want to call them, whatever category you have to fall into. Now, how much contact did he have with these other surfers? What was his personal life like? You know, how many people were coming up to him from this kind of mentality and going, are you going to let this happen? Are you going to let this national police brutality thing keep on going? Let's get rid of some of these people. How much of that was going on at that time that could have influenced his mind? You know, what was he seeing on TV? For instance, what was he reading? Who was he talking to? What kind of conversations was he having? I think that should be investigated to lead up to the psychology of where he was when he pulled that trigger. And I think that should be part of the public investigation. Well, thank you.
Excuse me.
What you're hearing here is testimony from a disabled man in a wheelchair who speaks, of course, with a serious speech defect, and he's with his caretaker. We should, of course, be translating this into easier-to-understand English, but for the purposes of simply passing on the variety of people who are at this hearing and the concern, I believe he was a resident at the place where Happy John lived. I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps some caller can enlighten us on this. Anyway, again, we continue with the Citizens Police Review Board testimony from last Monday.
Your name John Donne?
My name is Nicholas Whitehead. I was an associate producer recently for Shadow and Light Productions. We were planning a television program on this subject. In that capacity, I telephoned Jeff Locke, the lieutenant, to the deputy chief of police. I said one of the subjects I might like to broach in this television program was what alternative strategy could have been used by the police to deal with the situation. I asked him whether it wouldn't have been possible to have an officer or two go behind Mr. Dine, or to bring somebody with a microphone whose voice he would recognize to speak to him, as they've done in hostage situations. His answer to me was very brief and to the point. He said, "We don't have the people or the time to do that sort of thing." And I think that's true. As things are arranged now, they have to deal with the situation in as rapid a manner as possible. I think that's one of the reasons that John Dine was killed, because the police department has to be efficient. That's a policy question that should be looked into very strongly. So, another thing I did was look into the records, because a few years ago I was an investigator with a community group called Stop Police Abuse Now. I looked into the record of this officer, Kerry. He's not the usual type of police officer. He is a very proactive police officer. I have some records that I could hand over. A lot of this comes from recollection of what people told me at the time. At the beginning of the Gulf War, when Baghdad was being bombed, and there was a lot of intense feelings, and the community was heavily polarized, there was an occupation of the town clock by a group of would-be peace, protesters for peace, pacifists. Some of them were former military people. It went on for a long time. The city was patient with it, but eventually they did send in a squad of police, and there was a raid at dawn. There was a raid about 5 a.m. in a bitterly cold weather. An officer, Terry, appeared to be, if not the leader, one of the co-leaders of this raid.
37.
A lot of brutality was used in that raid. There, complaints were made to the police department at the time. And Officer Carey's name was definitely mentioned as one committing brutal acts. His name next came to my notice, accused of swinging somebody, an Irish immigrant, against a police car, swinging his face into a police car some years later, and I saw the man's face, and his nose was all bloody. So this is Officer Carey, and you've got to be careful. This man should be looked into. Thank you.
My name is Robert Grant, and I've been a resident of Santa Cruz for about 6 years now. And I've also taken it upon myself over the last 3 years to observe the police and listen to the radio transmissions as a member of Cop Watch at one time, and mainly for journalism that I do for Free Radio Santa Cruz, and record incidents between the police. I've run into Kerry a couple of times. He's always been a nice person to me. But as far as the police, not like I guess Nicholas was saying about the police not having the time, I guess Locke said, well, I've listened to a scanner and fallen asleep trying to wait for the next transmission open, especially in the evenings. You probably know that too. But as far as police policy, in a situation like that, I think the only question that hasn't risen out of this is why did they put their so-called witness in the back seat of the car in danger of a shooting? Why didn't they get the witness away and deal with this like they would a bank robbery, because they're in front of the bank, and every time I've listened to police transmissions, they've always had at least 3, 4, 5 police officers cover the bank, cover the area, and then they'll move in on the suspect or whatever crime is being committed. Now, I don't know why this policy wasn't taken, and why they put their witness and citizen in the back of the police car in danger And that's one question that I wanted answered out of this. And as far as radio transmissions, you should listen to the radio transmission from when the call came in, or if it was flagged down. And from then on to the incident, although the officer probably wouldn't have time to get on the radio if he was pulling his gun out. So those are the kind of questions I think we should look at, especially police policy. If you made a mistake, you made a mistake. I don't think anybody from John Dine's family is going to sue the city. So I think that we need to call a mistake if that's what it was, or if the police policy is wrong. I don't think Kerry is a killer cop, but I think we should look into this issue of police policy. So.
Board members, my name is Robert Norris. I work with SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, and a group called Santa Cruz and Full Disclosure, which has sent you some literature on concerns we have. A lot of issues have been raised here, and I think the real issues you're going to face in closed session is, after examining the report, do you need more information before deciding whether to sustain or exonerate or whatever a conclusion you need to come to? I'm going to suggest to you that you do need more information, and that the way to get this information is not through the police department. It is through an independent investigation and public hearings where you yourselves will be questioning key witnesses. And I say this for a couple of reasons. First, credibility. The police department cannot really credibly investigate itself. The district attorney's office and the sheriff's department can't really credibly investigate the police department here. I say that a priori. I think that would be true. Even if I didn't even look at the report, I think it would be useful and persuasive for the citizens to have your board, citizens, examine the police report. But in this case, you will find, if you look at that report, at least I found it from reading it over, that at least every single non-police witness, Leanna Forrest, Stacey Buckaloo, Mike Schultz, every single non-police witness did not see a gun in Dine's hand, did not see a gun pointed at the police, saw no threatening behavior. And those three conclusions were the conclusions of Chief Belcher 3 hours after the shooting. They were reiterated the next day at a press conference. I know you've heard this from me before, but this bears repeating. This was the conclusion of the police department and district attorney's office. It can't be your conclusion unless you feel the weight of the evidence of all these witnesses should overweigh that of two police officers, one of them who did the shooting, the other one who was his friend, or at least his partner, and then police officer's friend, Ben Newman, in the back of the car, who is the complainant, the man who made the complaint in the first place. You have to examine this independently in order to persuade anyone, I think, of a fair mind that this is being looked at. If you want to heal the wounds in the community, you have to deal with the wound first. You have to deal with the issue of justice first. The media has attacked this issue by attacking me. That's not the way to go about it. The issue you have to consider is, here for the first time, you have an opportunity to truly investigate this issue in a public forum where the real questions can be asked and need to be asked. I'm hoping that you'll hear from another person specifically about what those questions need to be. I think you've already got some written information on that. Call the witnesses not asked, like Tom Murphy was present. View the videotapes you need to do. Take all the time you need on this issue. Recess if necessary, but do the work necessary to come up with a conclusion we all can believe in. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Becky Johnson, and I sent a number of correspondences to each of you. I hope I didn't overwhelm you with paper or something, but I am one of the people that was able to go down and look through the district attorney's investigation, which I assume that all of you have also gone through. I thought there would be something in there, that there would be some witnesses that corroborated the police version of events. I thought there would be something that this professional police force would have come up with that supported the version that Happy John Dine was in a combat stance, that Happy John Dine had taken an aggressive manner, that Happy John Dine had pulled a very realistic looking toy gun from his from somewhere around his midsection, and then he pointed at the officers. He thought there'd be something there that would support that. But ultimately, what we come up with, and you look through the reports, and you look at their witness after witness after witness, and none of them saw a gun in Happy John's hand. I made this list here. It's got kind of like a shorthand list of who said what, and they had a lot of agreement, and they had a lot of disagreement. And this long list here, it says, eyewitnesses who did not see a gun in Happy John's hands, and by my count, police reports have 10 eyewitnesses to the shooting who did not see a gun in Happy John's hands. The only people that actually saw a gun in Happy John's hands was Officer Martin Over and Ben Newman in the back of the police car. And you'll even Connor Carey does not say that he had a gun in his hand and was pointing. Even Connor Carey does not say that he had a gun in his hand and was pointing it at the officers. He claims he shot him at the point where he was reaching for the gun. Again, not supported by any other witnesses. I don't see how you could possibly, looking at all of the evidence just in front of you, come to that conclusion. Now, as I've stated before this board, we have interviewed other eyewitnesses to the shooting who were not interviewed by the police, and we have videotapes of some of these witnesses. One in particular, Tom Murphy, who according to police reports was only 10 to 15 feet away from the scene. Now, he actually was a little further away, but he was the closest person on the sidewalk, and the interview with him is about that long. We have a very long videotape interview of him, and he is one of the witnesses who described the case as murder, along with two other eyewitnesses who have called the case murder. I'll be very interested in what you come up with here. Thank you.
My name is Michael Hilgers, and I'm hearing outside on the streets and all over that a lot of people are very, very upset about this. And there's a lot of street people who were good friends with him. And if this doesn't have a follow-up investigation and something happened, there's a lot of people that it just seems like they're really on edge. And there's a lot of people who I'm seeing as I left for a while and came back that are more and more kind of going over the deep end, you know, that are on the streets. There's a lot of people who are just like really in not a really good mental state. So I'm really concerned that if things like this are allowed to happen, then it's just going to infuriate the public more and more, and no telling what could happen in the future, you know, something like this, you know. And it just seems to me like I didn't read all the reports or know exactly what happened with the eyewitnesses, but if somebody doesn't actually show a gun and they're reaching down in their belt or their pocket, like maybe like for an ID or something, it would seem to me like it would have to be where the gun is actually shown, you know, at some point to be able to, you know, have an officer justifiably pull his revolver out. I don't know all the rules behind that, what's supposedly legal, but I just really pray that the justice really comes out of this, because if it doesn't, you know, if something doesn't really show up in the investigation, and I'm hearing a lot that, you know, it sounds like the investigation needs to really go as far as it possibly can. A lot of people are going to be very, very upset, and a lot of people don't feel safe, you know. And if we're not feeling safe with the people who are supposed to protect us out there, it's like something's very wrong. So I just really thank you all for doing your best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is the Sunday, January 4th, 1998 edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor. We're reviewing some cuts from the Citizens Police Review Board hearing on the Happy John Dine case, actually the public comment section before the closed hearing on the complaints. There were 7 or 8 complaints against Officer Connor Carey, who killed Happy John Dine on November 12th. Officer Martin Over, who was his partner, and Police Chief Steve Belcher, who called the shooting a justifiable homicide within 16 hours after the shooting. The Citizens Police Review Board will resume deliberations tomorrow, Monday, January 5th at 5:30 p.m. at 915 Cedar Street, not on the second floor of the library probably, but in its office, from which it may adjourn to the library. We have a few more cuts from this CPRB meeting. Very articulate speakers. And if you haven't spoken, we encourage you, that is, I encourage you, to go down to the meeting Monday at 5:30 of the Citizens Police Review Board at their office at 915 Cedar and Locust, and tell them your thoughts on this matter. They'll probably give you at least 3 minutes, more if you request time in advance.
Is there anyone else who would like to address the board?
Yeah, people.
My name is Shazer Eidstead. I'm a homeless person in Santa Cruz currently. I'm also known as Mr. Fidget.
Well, it looks like we got the beginning of Mr. Fidget, but not the end. Shaz has spoken on the air in the past, and he has been concerned about police abuse. He himself was given a ticket for sitting on the Scribner statue in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. A harmless activity and one customarily done, but if it's done by someone who's homeless or who looks poor and the police officer wants you gone, the downtown ordinances passed at the behest of the owner of the bookshop Santa Cruz, Neil Coonerty, who was our mayor in 1993 and was on the city council for 4 years, elected as a progressive by the Santa Cruz Action Network. Then you have to move right along and do what you're supposed to be doing. Anyway, I tend to digress. That was the Citizens Police Review Board hearing of last Monday. Tomorrow there will be another hearing and another chapter in this story, the outcome of which is to a significant extent dependent on what you, the listeners, decide to do. Again, I encourage you to go to your phone now and call the 24-hour message line of the Citizens Police Review Board, 429-3262, which I'll repeat again, and tell them your concerns about the Happy John Dine case, and then come down in public at 5:30 on Monday tomorrow at 915 Cedar Street and present those concerns. Again, the number to call for the Citizens Police Review Board is 429-3262. 3262. Well, we don't have a guest in the studio, but we're going to try to reach a guest, one we've spoken to before, a very well-spoken guest, who is active with the Santa Cruz, or the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, and I think we have him on the line here.
Hello.
Hi, Robert, how are you?
We're talking to
Marco Marocchi from the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz.
Ah, yes, Marco Marocchi. I can never remember your last name, Marco.
It's a Native American name.
Well, so last time we talked to you, we discussed the eviction deferment, or the owner-managed property eviction that kind of was forestalled in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about getting before City Council some similar protections here in Santa Cruz. You want to kind of recap that
sure.
for us?
We've sent away to Santa Monica, an attorney who works for the Rent Control Board, Tony Tracosta, sent us back copies of all of the eviction protections that are written into the rent ordinances for the cities of L.A., Berkeley, Santa Monica, San Francisco. So we got that package back, and we put it into a packet form and sent it out to certain people, namely the city and the county board of supervisors, and people interested within our tenants' rights union who want to help draft our own eviction protection ordinances.
And what kind of protections are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for all the just causes, and we're looking to tighten up some of the just causes also.
Can you itemize those for us?
Okay. There is non-payment of rent is one of the just causes.
In other words, that should be a cause for eviction.
But we don't want to have it to be blank carte blanche, you know. Mm-hmm. There's certain times when withholding of rent on grounds of habitability or using the repair and deduct law.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also instances of health, safety, and we're saying material, civil, or economic reasons for non-payment of rent.
What would those be, for instance?
Which ones?
The last, material.
The civil or economic?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those would have to be, say, if there was a protest to the high amounts of rent,
mm-hmm.
that could be used as a means of protesting. Say, if the landlords were en masse or collectively trying to come down hard on renters who are trying to exercise their rights and their contract rights,
mm-hmm.
And are having a dispute with the landlord, they would be able to withhold rent
mm-hmm.
for those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Say in in South Africa, this wasn't legal, but the withholding of rent became an economic and political act. You see, so people have the right to use rent money, I'm saying here, for the purposes of economic boycott or civil or an act of economic civil disobedience.
Uh-huh.
And it worked to help bring down apartheid in South Africa, the withholding of rent. So there has to be some justification for calling out the SWAT teams more than just non-payment of rent. Like, people have good cause for not paying their rent, you know, other than property rights causes or the failure of profits to be tremendous and at 20% as they always are for real estate. So that's what that clause is for, and I think we're going to get it, you see. But I have to put it in there anyway.
Has your just cause law ever been enacted in any other city?
Yes, non-payment of rent just cause has been enacted in other cities, but not the tag that I'm putting along on it. That's where I'm
so that would be something novel.
I'm asking for the extra
new
3 miles, yes, indeed. And I have to, that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the second one is illegal purpose. It should pertain only to felonies. See, on most of the eviction protection ordinances, any illegal action is what they use, the phrase. Now, in some states, you know, you can be having sex with your wife or your boyfriend and be evicted for it.
Hmm.
What I'm saying, any illegal action. So we want to be read as felonious action.
Or perhaps sitting on the sidewalk.
Yeah, or sitting on the sidewalk in front of your house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So late fees and late payments are usually used as a reason for ending a lease, and we want that to be renegotiated completely. they're not just causes for evicting somebody. Late fees need to be renegotiated because I don't think. Unless the landlord is actually paying late fees to the bank, which they usually aren't, then I don't think late fees should apply. And so we have to redefine what late fees and late payments means. And then breach of contract is the fourth one. We want it to be very tightly defined. And then we want to redefine or define more fully contract. What does contract incompetent mean exactly? I mean, do both sides have a right to negotiate on every aspect of it, you know, or is it always just the landlord giving us something to sign? Do we have a right to give them something to sign, take that and give them something back,
mm-hmm.
and start negotiating?
I'll just put you out on the street and then negotiate with the other 49 people looking for a place to stay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's, but they'd have to go through the whole eviction process before they can do that, legally do that.
If you can get this law passed by the Kennedy-Rodkin Council.
Mm. Well, I think I'm going to try and get it done in the county first.
And the county is even more conservative, of course.
I know, but I think we can swing the third vote. And I don't want to be too quick. I guess because of a phone conversation I had with someone since I spoke to you, I found out that it might not be a good strategy to the city, doing just the city, because the real estate has like a $100,000 war chest, and
mm-hmm.
we're lucky if we can raise $10,000 or $1,000,
mm-hmm.
you know. And one time in the city, they were going to pass eviction protections without the rent control.
When was this?
This is a few years ago. And real estate just jumped right on it and almost had enough signatures within the city to repeal it, to put it on the ballot to repeal it. And so the city took it off on their own. So that's what we're up against. Okay, so now we have to re-strategize that somewhat, and I'm thinking of taking an alternate route or having to develop the mass movement previous to this. I'm urging everybody to call up 10 people, and urging them to, the 10 people they call up, to get them to call at least 5. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the only way we're going to do this. You know, then we can get to up to numbers like, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500, and have a get together, a rally, a convention, and really, we really have to get people out there who really want to do something. To do something with this rent parties. I want to call them rent parties, like once a month having rent parties. Mm-hmm. Somewhere where we can have like 100 people, 200 people.
How can people help you now?
Huh?
How can people help?
People can help by calling up, volunteering their time. They can help with the Unlawful Detainer Project, which Donna operates smoothly every day. She goes down to the city clerk's office, goes through all the files that were filed that day, and pulls out the files that are unlawful detainers, goes into those files individually, writes down the person's name, the defendant's name, the renter who's being filed upon with the unlawful detainer, takes down their name and address, puts it on a postcard, and sends it out to them. Because there's no phone, it would be so much easier. So one of the things on our eviction protections would be that there'd be phone numbers on all this stuff. So we could just pick up the, you know, get the phone number from the document, and call them directly. Uh-huh. We'd be able to help a lot more people with the Unlawful Detainer Project right now if we had that option. But a lot of people are responding to the postcards. She mails out, you know, last month 40 postcards. She got a response back from 20.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Or more, 20 or more.
You're also publishing a newsletter, right?
Yes, we have a newsletter coming out. We have a second newsletter coming out.
How can folks get a copy of that newsletter?
Well, they could call us up at 426-0644.
426-0644. That's also the number they can use to volunteer to help in the Unlawful Detainer Project and in your campaign to get basic protections for renters, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the number. And if they want to send us donations and checks, they could send us P.O. Box 7484, Santa Cruz, 95061.
Repeat that address, could you?
P.O. Box 7484, Santa Cruz, 95061-7484.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Oh, yes. We are calling together a meeting with tenants' unions up in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
We're calling together a regional tenants' congress. It's a tenants' congress is a related project, or a tenants' rights union in Santa Cruz is also related to the tenants' congress. And I've talked to people in San Francisco Tenants' Rights Union and Oakland Defense Network and Christine up at the Weston Center for Law and Poverty. Mm-hmm. And we're really, it's time to get together a regional tenants congress, a union of tenants' unions for this region right now, the Northern California, and then we're going to bring in L.A., and then we're going to go from statewide, we're going to go Western states, Eastern states, and National Tenants Congress. I think that's the general idea of what we want to be doing. And the purpose of this meeting is also, besides identifying ourselves as a National Tenants Congress, is to initiate some mass actions around the rent eviction formula, mostly because the rents are so high. See, in San Francisco, where they have rent control, rents have still gone up 30% in recent years.
Amazing.
Like within the last 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years, rents have gone up 30%. So one of the things I've been urging all along is the 30% reduction in rent. You see, now if people would have taken me up on it, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, there wouldn't have been this 30% increase by now.
If only they'd listened to you, Marco. Go ahead.
So that's going to be one of the mass actions. So we can do that if it's a mass action. We can avoid the whole eviction process because there's a lot of eviction protection laws and a lot of cities and counties won't mass evict people with SWAT teams, because that's probably, you know, what it would take. It would be so expensive to arrest 100 households in the post-eviction judgment period.
You have actually people have committed themselves to this kind of militant action?
But people are committing, yes, people have committed themselves to this kind of militant action, to the reduction of their rents. We've gotten, in Santa Cruz alone, over 250 signatures in the past 3 years or so. I mean, putting it out just intermittently.
Mm-hmm.
And also people who are strongly opposed to eviction. So you can't have lower, you can't lower rents in mass. I mean, because that's the real solution to the problem. It's not rent control, it's lowering the rents. You know, lowering the rents by 50, 60, 70%. I mean, the rents have gone up 25, 30% in the last few years. We should roll them back that much, plus some. You know, then maybe we'll be getting ahead. And that's the general attitude of all renters and even renters activists at this point.
So when is this Congress going to be happening?
Well, we have one session for February 17th at the Pueblo Building in Valencia, 474 Valencia. It'll be an afternoon session, four-hour session. Just kind of get together and how do you do, an exchange of information and stuff. We plan to have a lot of these ongoing.
This is up in San Francisco.
Up in San Francisco. Plan to have like some coordinating and steering committee meetings at the San Francisco Tenants Union with Ted G and the gang up there. With the program I'm pushing here, I'm pitching for. Ted from the San Francisco Tenants Union, he seems to really, really like the idea. and so do other people. I don't know how high up they are.
Well, if folks want more information, I encourage them to give you a call.
Give us a call here, 426-0644. Mm-hmm. And you can write us at P.O. Box 7484, Santa Cruz 95061, 7484.
Again, that's 426-0644 for more information on the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz. Talk to Marco or Donna, and if you want those numbers repeated, just give me a call at 423-HUFF later, and I'll try and dig them up for you. Thanks a lot, Marco.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's good to have you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
See you. How's it going?
And it's Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, that you are listening to. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert, for the next hour. Without my bathrobe, I will be here. You'll be listening to interviews with Keith McHenry.